You are in the Senate Education and Workforce Committee. If this isn't where you want to be, this is your time to exit.
Okay.
If you have... No. You're stuck. If you have a cell phone, please put it on vibrate so you can be courteous to the rest of us. And I'm Vicki Walker, your chair, and I'm happy that you're all here today. We've got an exciting program for our committee today. We're going to have committee a presentation from Gateway to College. It is a program through the Portland Community College. And the reason we're having that hearing is because we're going to have another hearing after that on Senate Bill 300, which sort of ties in with that. And also because I read an article in the Oregonian about Gateway to College on January 23. And I was so impressed with what I read about this program that I came back to the Capitol and told Marjorie we needed to get them to come in and talk about their program. So that's why we're hearing that today. Also, just before we get started, I want to give you a brief update on the ESD work group. I'm going to finalize that work group this evening, and we'll announce that work group tomorrow. And they will begin their work next Tuesday. And as indicated before, Senator Cruz has agreed to chair that work group. So with that, I think we'll move into our informational hearing on Gateway to College. And we have Linda Huddle, who is the Director of Alternative Programs at Portland Community College, that will come forward and tell us about that program. And then you'll need to identify yourself.
Yes. Hi.
If you would, please.
Yes. I'm Linda Huddle, Director of Alternative Programs at Portland Community College. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about Gateway to College. And I've prepared a couple different things. We weren't able to bring students with us today, so I have a short five-minute DVD of a couple of our students talking about their experience. So I thought we'd start with that.
Great.
And then I have a PowerPoint presentation on Gateway to College, the model, the outcomes, and also the national replication. We are replicating this model nationally at 17 colleges through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So I have a little piece on that. And then time for questions, and I don't know what your usual format is, but if you want to interrupt during the presentation, I feel free to.
We often do that.
I bet you do. So if you'd like, we'll just start with the students.
Yeah, and we'll turn the lights down, and you'll have until 4 o'clock, Ms.
Okay.
Huddle, so
we'll time ourselves here.
Go from there.
Sound worked earlier.
Uh-oh. I was in a committee last session that went... That's what happened last session.
Let's see if it works with the lights on. It worked with the lights on. So I I think maybe we should go on and come back to this if we can't get it.
Yeah, why don't we do the PowerPoint and then we'll get tech support.
But for not for very long.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to switch it over. Well, we won't start with our students. You do have...
And then lights. Thank you.
Okay, you have in your packet this a paper version of this PowerPoint.
Okay. Which is good for those of us who can't see very well.
So we're going to talk about why Gateway to College is important and what the model looks like, what the outcomes are, and what the replication is all about. First, I want to start by saying that at Portland Community College, we feel that young people can be successful in this environment, even though they haven't been successful in the traditional high school environment, provided that they have multiple ways to enter, that they have a program to enter that kind of meets them where they're at, and that there's plenty of supports for them when they enter this program. We have a full wraparound set of services for young people. They just aren't kind of thrown into the college environment without having staff to help them along the way. So we have a continuum of services, and this represents what the continuum looks like, and it represents the multiple ports of entry. Besides Gateway to College, which is what we call a pinnacle, because that's where students can get dual credit. They get high school credit and college credit by taking college courses for high school credit as well as college credit. But at the bottom of this pyramid, you'll see something that says MAP, Multicultural Academic Program. That's for students with limited English proficiency, and we work with those young people to get their literacy levels up to where they can begin working on GED or high school diploma. On the far right, we have something that says YES, that's Youth Empowered to Succeed, and that's focused on GED prep, because what we find is that many students don't have the vision of being able to do college work when they come to us. They know they want to work on their education. They think GED is probably the only option. So if that's where they're at, that's where we meet them, and they start in the YES program, and when they're with us, then we try to open their eyes to the other possibilities that are available for them beyond getting their GED. But the GED is a good, legitimate first goal for many students. The center represents all the other ways that students come to us. They come to us self-referred, their parents bring them, they're referred by local school district counselors. We do work with young people who are on the verge of dropping out but haven't yet dropped out, but most of our students have actually walked out of school and have been out for some time before they come to us. So that's the continuum of services. So one of the things we're trying to do with Gateway to College is to dispel some of the myths about high school dropouts and the stereotypes that there are about high school dropouts, because we feel it's important for people to understand that high school dropouts can do college-level work and they can be successful academically and personally. And that what we've found is for young people, many times the reason they haven't been successful isn't due to academic inability, even though they may not have achieved in high school, it's really due to a lot of other factors. And you can see some of the factors listed there on the screen. For a lot of young people, and you'll hear this once we get a chance to hear from the students, that they begin to believe in themselves and their abilities once they get into a situation where they're supported, they're not anonymous any longer, they feel like people care about them, and they start to develop a sense of worth and achievement. They become motivated, and even in the toughest environments, college environment, they're able to be successful. So this gives you a quick look at what the model is. And again, we're working with 16 to 20-year-olds who have dropped, for the most part, have dropped out of high school and have made the decision that they want to come back. So it is high school completion and associate degree or credits toward their associate's degree. And we'll have some data a little bit later about how many college credits they actually are able to achieve during the time they're with us. It's a rigorous curriculum. It's not a special high school curriculum. It's the general college curriculum that they take. The courses are listed in the college catalog. For the most part, they study along with other adult learners. There is ongoing student support, and this is a critical feature of this, is that they have what we call student resource specialists who are like advisors or counselors who work with them during the entire time they're with us to provide support, problem-solving suggestions, coaching, mentoring, parenting, to help them as they move their way back into a successful experience in school. The initial cohort experience that they are involved in is a learning community. It lasts from 1 to 2 terms, so that's from 11 to 22 weeks. And the purpose of the cohort is for them to build their skills so they can do the work that is, will be demanded of them when they start taking transferable college credits. So what does a student look like? We'll have more detailed information about what the student looks like a little later, but just generally 16 to 20, on the verge of or having dropped out of school, even the ones that are in school, what we hear from the students themselves is, well, they may have been on the rolls, but they weren't really either attending, or if they were attending, they weren't doing any work. They have to be behind in school credits for the age and grade level, and you can look at the little blue box over there, and you can see that the average number of high school credits for the young people we've worked with over the last 4.5 years is 7.3. Their age is 17.8, which means they're senior by age, but just barely into their sophomore year by credit. And their GPA of a 1.7, again, is not going to get them into a college on their own steam from what they were able to do in high school. They need to live in an eligible school district. What that means is we have contracts with local school districts. It's pass-through money through the alternative ed law, mm-hmm. and that's what funds this program. And so I work with Portland, Beaverton, Tiger Tualatin, and Lake Oswego school districts for this particular program. And the students have to want to be there. If a parent brings their kid along to try to get them off the couch to go back to school, that's not going to work for the student. They have to want to be there. So we do a lot of screening for motivation and interest. So the essential elements of this program is it's part of the college. We don't call it a high school. Students consider themselves college students. It's located on a college campus. It's not down the street in an off-site location. And that's very important to students, as you will hear. The small learning community, a cohort, that first-term experience where they're building skills is a critical feature. It's a more sheltered environment than they're going to get when they start taking courses with the other adult learners. And we really are reinforcing a positive learning environment where we're reinforcing how students work with effectively with an instructor, how not to avoid the challenges that may come up for you. We also, if they complete the first term successfully with C or better in all classes, then we transition them or move them on to general education courses with all other adult learners. We do quite a bit to evaluate them. Students need to have an eighth grade reading level, and we do a lot of other looking at grammar and mechanics. We look at their math skills, so we make them jump through a lot of hoops to show us that they want to do this. An important feature to students is its flexible scheduling. They don't have to go 5 days a week, 6 hours a day. They can go morning, afternoon, evening, part-time, full-time. This will help them accommodate all the other things that are going on in their lives. Another feature is the staff that we have working with this. We have student resource specialists. We have faculty who work with students in their first-term cohort experience that are specifically selected because of their interest and abilities in working with this population. For all the staff, it's more like it's a mission as opposed to a job. They really do feel that working with these young people is an important piece of themselves. There's ongoing collaboration with the various the resource specialists and the faculty so that we make sure that students are accountable and they're not able to triangulate between different adults that are working on their behalf. Another key feature is, and it's kind of encapsulated by no lost credits, is that we've aligned the high school completion requirements with the college's degrees and certificates and created majors, career majors that are aligned with the high school completion requirements, so that when they take their courses, they're also making progress every step of the way on their associate's degree. So we have over 50 of these pathways of career majors that we created at PCC. So this is kind of what the flow, quick flow of what the model looks like. So readiness is where we get them from either from in our internal programs that are part of PCC's alternative programs or from other community organizations. Foundational skills represents the cohort, and that's really a solid foundation. Core coursework are the courses that would fall into the required subject areas for the high school diploma. So we want students to get the math out of the way so they don't get to almost being done and they haven't touched their math requirements. So they do the core coursework that will prepare them solidly for all the other discipline-specific courses they'll have to take. So they take reading, writing, and math in their core coursework and get those skills up so that they are the best possible students. Advanced coursework pertains to all the subjects, all the courses that pertain to their major area of interest. And then they graduate with their high school diploma and continue on their education. We have last year, 57% of our students who graduated continued on either at PCC or at Portland State. This is a little bit more detail. This kind of goes down in layers of detail, but this is a little more detail about placement. So when we test them for reading, if they make the eighth grade reading level, then they go on to an evaluation to determine appropriateness for gateway to college. If they are less than an eighth grade reading level, what we do is we have a catch-up course to get their skills up to eighth grade. It's a pre-gateway, so we would evaluate them for that. If they're below a seventh grade, then we would try to find another educational option. We want students, if they've taken the step of coming to PCC to inquire about going back to school, we want to make sure that they have an option to go to. If it's not with us, it's with someone else. So we would try to either get them into the GD prep program, into the program for limited English speakers, or with one of our other alternative education providers that are in our area. So more detail. So this actually shows you what kind of courses they take in that first term. If you look at the lower block that says Gateway to College Cohort Experience, they're taking four classes. And they're developmental, with the exception of one class, they're developmental ed college classes. So reading, writing, math. College Survival, it is a transferable course. Students can transfer that credit to Portland State University. That course is focused on helping students develop the skills that they are going to need to survive as students. Study habits, decision making, time management, acclimatizing students to different kinds of textbooks that they're going to see, writing styles that are required. Academic Lab is an experience where we're trying to also help them develop deeper skills in specific areas. We found that students would sit in class, they take their assignment, go home, and then not know what in the world, how to approach the assignment. So we developed an Academic Lab so students could practice in a direct instruction method skills, certain skills that they're going to need to be able to do on the just as it's part of them when they get out on that campus and are starting to take their history and econ classes. So they get 12 college credits. One is transferable, 12 credits that show up on their college transcript, and that is two high school credits in that first term. After they make it through that first term, then they go into the transition time. We have a few other courses that we offer directly to kind of keep the apron string tied to us so we can watch them. There's some additional study skills courses that they take. Their math, as they're making progress through the math, we hire the math instructors and give them some really intensive math instruction after they leave the cohort so that they have a good send-off. So what do these students look like? So students have, as you can see here, problems in the area of social skills and motivation. And so one of the things we're doing in that first term especially is working on motivation. One of the reasons they didn't do well in high school is they didn't do their homework. And they maybe didn't come to class. We're getting them to come to class. Our attendance rate is 92% for these students. And we're working on homework. It is still a challenge, and that's one of the things we're trying to attract in the first term. We're trying to also help them with responsibility and accountability, meaning that if a student doesn't do their homework, rather than avoidance, we're trying to help students learn the skills of being accountable for not doing the homework and then learning actions to take in order to resolve the situation with their instructors. So we also have students who are English is not their first language. So about 10% of the students we have are English language learners that have progressed to the point where they can do this kind of work. it's a diverse population. Besides language acquisition skills, it's also a diverse population in terms of race, ethnicity, lifestyle, needing to work, all kinds of situations they bring to the table. And there's actually in your packet, there's a handout that is in color that shows you some of the distinguishing characteristics of our students. They also have a lot of different issues, dealing with family, emotional issues, dealing with frustration is a big one, and when they are frustrated, how to handle that frustration in an affirmative way. Many of our students also work either to support themselves or their family. We have a number of students who are parenting, so there's just a number of different issues they bring. So the cohort, what the cohort is to try to achieve from a curriculum and instruction perspective, and I've kind of pounded on this a bit already, is again to develop those basic skills and to also give them a sound basis for approaching classes in the future. So we expose them to many different kinds of reading requirements. We're not having them read poetry or literature, but we're having them read in the disciplines. So they know when they take history or econ, they know what kind of textbook they're going to be looking at. They know what it's going to be organized, how it's going to be organized. And the writing, we have them do expository writing rather than creative writing, because that's the kind of writing they're going to need when they take any of their classes. So we're trying to expose them to all of these kind of basic fundamental things they're going to need to know to be successful in any class. We also, again, work on academic habits and the effective relationships with instructors. And you'll hear from students that, you know, this is the first time I ever had an instructor who I thought really cared about me. So, I mean, a lot of times students become invisible in larger high schools, and it's not that teachers don't care about them, it's just that they're dealing with large numbers of students. The cohort is 20 to 25 students, so the instructor is able to develop a relationship with the students, and even though it's only for 11 weeks, if you're spending the 33 to 40 hours with that student and there's only 20 to 25 in the classroom, you do have time to make those connections that are very meaningful to the students.
Ms. Huddle,
yes.
I just want to state that that's an excellent point, that we have really good teachers in our state, but they don't have the luxury of having 20 to 25 students in their classroom, and so some of these kids do feel like they don't get that one-on-one attention.
Exactly, yeah. And it's really, I'm a former teacher from a long time ago, but I dealt with lots of numbers, and it really is very frustrating on the part of most teachers not to have that time to make those connections, because you know the students need that, and you also as a teacher know that it's very important, and it just gets lost. Mm-hmm. So
mm-hmm.
So in terms of the student services perspective or the student support perspective, oh, by the way, this young man that's pictured here, he was an English language learner. He came to us with very little English and has left us to go to Hawaii to start managing a 24-hour fitness center, and when he left us, he was in the advanced levels of our MAP class. So, and I read one of his final essays that he sent to the instructor thanking his last instructor for the help. It was a 4-page essay. And yes, there were a few, you could tell he was an English language learner, but it was a very coherent and excellent format. And so we saw this young man go from minimal English to being able to kind of work in a facility and have some management responsibilities. So there are stories connected to all these spaces here, because all of these spaces are our students. So one of the things that's happening with students is they all come with stories. And so we are offering the students also the opportunity to rewrite their story, to start afresh. They're in a new environment. They have new expectations. And so for many students, they are kind of rethinking what they did before. They know that and we remind them that their old behaviors didn't work too well in high school, and they're clearly not going to work very well in this environment. So it's very important to kind of rethink how you choose to handle situations. So this is an opportunity for rewriting the story. Also, we're working with their motivation, both the internal and external motivation, and helping students become more aware of why they do what they do. Setting goals is important, and again, in the folder that handout that deals that has is the colored handout, you'll see that one of the last items that was pointed out there is that we asked students who came in what their academic or educational goals are, and you'll find in that little chart that over 70% of the students said that they wanted to at least get a bachelor's degree. So they are thinking and, you know, working on where it is they want to be. We also are balancing support with accountability, and we may be, and you'll hear resource specialists talk with students in a very firm, strong, challenging way at times, but then another time you'll hear them talk with students in a very supportive way, and I've heard students regard this kind of support, the resource specialist, as kind of their guardian angel. Thinking critically and independently is another area that we're working on, a very important skill for life and for college. Peer-to-peer support, that's very important. And again, having that small number of students that are in this experience, they're all in it together, they're all going through the same things. And for many students, this is the first time they've had real friends. That's another thing you'll hear. Some students didn't connect up, they moved around so much that they weren't able to establish relationships. And if they did, sometimes the relationships weren't as helpful as they could have been. So here, everybody's kind of working towards the same goal. And you'll hear students get frustrated at some other students who are maybe not taking it as seriously as others, because for some this is critically important. And then getting students ready for college, like acclimating them to the college campus and making sure they know how to be a student. And once they leave Gateway to college and are off, we want them to know when they do come back to college, they know the ropes. They know all about all the student services. They know how to apply for financial aid. They know, you know, who to ask for help. So we do work on other areas as well. Students participate in the SIM assessments. We've aligned the state standards with the college classes. We don't do placement testing for students for college-level work until after they completed the cohort. The reason being, we want to make sure that students have had their skills honed and sharpened so they can be placed in the highest level of course that fits their skills at that time. Our goal is to have as many students as possible get their skills up so they do not have to take any additional developmental ed level courses. And last time I checked that particular statistic, we were sitting at about half the students were able to move into 100 level transferable college courses at the end of that 11-week cohort. And we expect students to maintain at least a C or better. Even though a D will get a student credit at the college, we don't accept Ds for this program because we feel that it's not preparing them for the challenges they'll have in the future. If they don't meet that standard, we have different kinds of counseling strategies we use with them, success contracts to help them get on back on track to at least getting a C. And I recently did a study on the percent of students who got a C average or better their first term out after completing the cohort, and 75% of our students had a C average or better their first term after the cohort. So I talked about this curriculum alignment. That's a big feature where, again, we're working on no wasted classes taken. Again, we want all courses to apply to their college goals as well as their high school goals. This next lovely chart, you really can't read it, and we didn't expect you to read it, but what this pertains to is this is an example of a college advising tool. So if a student was interested in business management, Oregon Transfer, these are the courses they would be taking to fulfill their high school completion requirements. And you can see, you know, there's all the History 101, 102. They're taking Econ 200, 201. They're taking Biology. And then down below where it says electives, there are additional courses that are related to business management that they would be taking. So we have over 50 of those for different subjects a student might be interested in. This way there's no opportunity for the student to miss out on getting the right courses. So how we fund it, I touched on that briefly, but it is through local contracts with local school districts through the alternative education law. I have contracts for a certain number of student FTE or ADM. We're only paid when students attend. So it's not like we get a grant for X number of students and whether they come or not, we get paid. Not so. We only get paid when they attend, so that's why attendance is really important to us, too. And like I said, we have a 92% attendance rate for students in this program.
Carol, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is the alternative ed law, does that money come from the state school fund that each district gets?
It comes from the state, and I don't think it comes, it doesn't, it's not part of the school district's general fund allocation. It's tracked on students who are retrieved to the system, so they're new enrollments into the system. And so I don't know if I'm going to answer this exactly in a way that will make sense. So when we have a contract with the school district, the money set for those students to fund those students comes to the district the year after the student is retrieved. So it does flow to the district, but a year afterwards. And so for a school district's allocation for the year, for the students that they report as their enrollments, these students are on top of that because they're new students into the district. Does that answer your question?
Well, kind of, sort of. And then these students must be living within the district, and there's nothing that prevents them from moving into the district so they can then take advantage of your program.
Right, yeah, because then they would live in the district. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but it's... these students are counted. We report our enrollments to the district, and the district then rolls it into their enrollments and submits it to the state.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what the district may report to the state on October 1st, we're not in that pool because they're new students to the district that have been returned to the district.
So what I want to be clear about is the district doesn't lose any money in this
program?
Does
not lose any money. They actually gain money from this because they can retain up to 20% of the ADM for those students mm-hmm. returned to. Mm-hmm. And also, interestingly enough, we recently did a study with the dropouts in the Portland Public School System and the impact of the alternative programs. There are about 18 different alternative education providers in the Portland Public Schools system network, and all of those alternative providers are retrieving students. And the impact of last year's activity was that the high school enrollment in Portland Public Schools was increased by 14% by the students that were returned through the alternative education providers. Because we found that many students who were not attending, who came back into any number of alternative education providers and were re-enrolled at Portland Public Schools.
I see.
So that's new. That's kids back in the district who were out on the streets, not working on their education, and it's additional resources to the district to help support those students.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So just a summary on the Gateway model, what it is and what it isn't, is that, one, we're part of the campus, part of the college, not a standalone, and that's very important to students to be considered college students. In effect, they've caught up with their peers who graduated from high school. Secondly, it's a transportable model, meaning it's not bound to a particular building. We move that cohort to different campuses at PCC to be close to where students are. The easier it is to get to the campus, the higher likelihood is that students will make it there and attend regularly. Also, again, they take college level classes for high school and college credit. There's no high school only courses. Rigorous curriculum, as I've talked about, and then the high expectations of at least a C to maintain a good standing with this particular program. So here's a little quote from our students about how the student felt about their experience. Was behind in high school, credits, and didn't do well, worked a lot, but Gateway to College gave them a way to get high school and college at the same time, and for the first time they can see themselves staying in school. So I think this represents motivation, definitely. So here's some stats. So we've done 42 of these cohorts, starting in spring of 2000, with a 92% attendance rate average, 65% of the students had completed the, successfully completed the cohort. That means completing all the classes with a C or better so that they're able to move on. And then, as I said earlier, when they did move on, 75% of the students got a C average or better their first term after the cohort. Because these are kind of like little watershed points where you have to watch for a slippage. Okay, by the end of the spring 2004, that's a 17th term of Gateway to College, we had had by that time 43 high school diplomas. One thing to realize about this program, and this is one of the things that often students don't understand, is this is not a quick way to get your high school diploma. It actually takes longer because each college course is only worth a half a high school credit. So you can take a whole term of writing 121 and it's only worth a half a high school credit. So it takes longer and it's harder. But our graduates earned an average of 66 college credits. It takes 90 credits to get an associate's degree at Portland Community College. And so you can see the student is well over halfway to their associate's degree. Some of these 66 credits are developmental ed. They don't count towards the associate's degree, but I'd say at least half the credits listed there are did count towards associates. We had five that actually got the associates at the same time. And then overall, 72% of the students continued their education, either at the community college or at a four-year institution.
And they already have the credits.
They took the credits. They took at least 66 credits with them.
That's great.
Yeah. Okay. And that, again, we get a chance to hear from the students, you'll hear why that's important. So on the 2003-04 graduates, we had 21 just last year alone. This group had 71 credits. And earned a total of 12 high school credits. So you can see how many college credits they had to take to get 12 high school credits. And 24% of these students who entered with a less than a 2-point graduated with honors. So here's some, I won't go over this because it is in your information and we're running a little bit late, but We're doing a student survey of all students when they enter the program, and this represents students from PCC, Riverside Community College, and Montgomery College in Maryland. These were our first time we did this. There's about 200 and almost 300 students in this survey. So you can see here kind of what they bring in that 21% of the students had at least one parent who didn't graduate from high school. You can see that a third of them had parents who didn't go to college. 9% weren't born in the U.S. 8% don't live with their families, even though they're quite young. 45% work. 78% cited infrequent attendance as the reason they didn't do well in traditional high school. And again, when you look through that sheet, the colored sheet, you'll see that on this why didn't they do well in high school statistic, that over 70% of the students said that there were at least three different reasons they didn't do well in high school, and those might have ranged from not attending to feeling like they didn't matter or didn't count in the high school setting. So I thought that particular item on your information sheet is particularly, I think, pertinent to what we need to pay attention to help students stay in school. So 7% homeless. So you can see they're dealing with a lot of things in addition to just trying to do schoolwork. Okay, our challenges are persistence. And what we mean by persistence is sticking with it. And so what we did find is that about two-thirds of the students who were eligible for our retention study, and what our retention study means is, were the students still there actually four terms after completing the cohort? So that's over a year. And so we have two-thirds of our students who had persisted. That's our biggest thing that we work on, is increasing the retention rate of students. So they leave for many different reasons, and you can see a few of the reasons here. They also leave because sometimes we ask them to leave, and we will ask them to leave if they are not meeting their our standards of maintaining a C average or better, and we will not drop them immediately. We will work with them for a number of terms to help them get up to there, but it is we expect the students to be responsible for their actions and to work on resolutions for their particular situations that are getting in the way of their making progress. And so if it looks like after several terms they're not making progress, we'll ask them to sit out and think about it, come up with some plans, and they're always welcome to come back and ask to come back. We will take students who, you know, thought through their situation and come up with strategies to make progress towards their goals.
And have you had students do that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but we wanted to also say that despite the persistent being a problem, this is, they do have big dreams, and this is the chart I was talking about, where 72% of the students said that they wanted to get at least a bachelor's degree when they just straight out when they started with us. And I thought it was very interesting that only 10% had high school diploma as their end goal for being a part of this program. So, and some of them are achieving. So, of the group that graduated last year, 88% made the honors list at least once during the time they were with the program. And again, 72% say they're continuing on with their education. So, here's another comment from a student. They had a habit of quitting. And so we've taught them something about themselves, and they feel like they now can do what they need to do and that they finally have a place. So that's another, again, in terms of helping students be accountable and not quit, but to find the way, the path to their solution for their situation. So here's a little bit about Early College High School Initiative, and hopefully we can get this DVD rolling so you can hear from students themselves. But so the Early College High School Initiative is a national initiative sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and it's focused on first-generation, low-income English language learners and students of color to increase their attainment, completion of high school and attainment of associate's degree, and or 2 years of college credit. And there are 12 intermediary organizations that are working on this particular effort, of which Portland Community College is one. We put ourselves in bold, but you can see the list of all the other ones. It's a national effort. The other early college high schools are not working with high school dropouts. We're kind of unique and sort of a hybrid. And the other early college high school initiatives are working on students before they've dropped out, and they're starting with ninth graders, and with the idea of not having them drop out, but to create an environment and a situation where they will stay in school and they will accelerate their movement into college by virtue of having them start college-level courses when they are ready. So the theory is that by the time they finish their fourth or fifth year of high school, it may take 5 years, they will have that associate's degree or the 60 credits. And by the time they're juniors, they'll be taking primarily college classes for the high school credit and college credit. So that's what the overall Early College High School Initiative is about. And there are some green folders in your packets that give you more information about the Early College High School Initiative and the national initiative. So in terms of the Early College High School Initiative, as of September 2004, there were 46 of these early college high schools open in 19 states, over 8,000 students involved in this effort. And you can see the types of schools. So there are charter schools, regular schools, all kinds of models they're using for the early college high school, much of it dependent upon what the regulatory climate is for funding. And at the end of it all, they expect to have 170 of those schools and over 65,000 students engaged in early college efforts. So this is our rollout. We'll be doing 17 schools here at Portland Community College. We hope that we'll have more than two gateway to colleges in Oregon, one at PCC, one at Clackamas, and maybe we'll have some other colleges that will be interested in doing this model. And so we're very excited about having this opportunity to roll this model out nationally. I think it's great for the state, and it's great for Portland Community College to be engaged in this national initiative. So here you can see where our early colleges or our gateway to colleges are located around the country. And just a last couple words from students. Focusing on my peers has always been a big problem. I love how college tends to focus on academics instead of socialization. You'll hear students talk about the drama. There's too much drama in high school, and college is calmer, and it's less crowded. This program is so different than high school, I feel challenged academically, and that's something I haven't felt in a long time. So that's another point of view from students. So can we try the DVD again? And this is 5 minutes. Do you have any questions?
I think Senator Starr did. Thank you.
Question regarding funding. You said the school, you have contract with the high school.
That we're getting.
There are other programs where schools are... Our students are allowed to go to community college as they're completing their high school.
Yes.
Some of the high schools are paying their tuition for the courses.
Right.
Others are not. But that seems to me to be a way for students who are the upper end of the bell curve, particularly, to advance their learning, speed it up.
Right. Beaverton District has a partnership program with Rock Creek, and they take one class with their home high school and then take the rest of the courses at the Rock Creek campus. And they actually have a staff person on campus. Beaverton provides a staff person on the Rock Creek campus to work with students. And the district does pay for tuition and books. This program, if I didn't mention it, we pay tuition and books for students, and the students pay the fees, and then we provide all the wraparound support and that I talked about as part of the package that students get. So I think it's having that support. I just can't emphasize how important that is to having a younger population on a campus setting.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's what we had before.
You know what I do in this situation?
There.
I do.
Restart. Did any of the members have any other questions about the program?
If you notice, colleagues, in the packet that Ms. Huddle provided to you, she's provided the article in the Oregonian that I was speaking of earlier that caught my eye. It was really fun to read about how these kids were doing so well. And I like your attendance policy. How do you get them to attend? That's just if you don't go out and hunt them down. That's just the policy, and if you don't follow it, you're out of the program.
We don't hunt them down, but the resource specialist, if the student starts to not attend, the resource specialist is on the phone saying, "You're not attending. You got to come in and see me. Why are you not attending? What's going on?"
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're working on that accountability the entire time. So. When they're out, when they're actually taking classes with the general student population, it often will take us a while to find out that they're not attending. And again, we do ask students to be accountable for that. Mm-hmm. So, but we don't call them at home and say, are you attending? They do turn in attendance once a month. We have a timesheet, like a kind of like a job, mm-hmm. and they turn that in. They self-certify that they are attending, and they're pretty honest about that. So that's how we do that.
Great. Do you think you have it now? Well, there's an arrow. We've never had the arrow. Okay.
Well, I'm really sorry.
Well, students, but I do appreciate you coming in and talking about your program, and it segues very nicely into okay. what we're going to be talking about next. We're talking here about students who are dropouts,
mm-hmm.
and I think the program that we're looking at next are taking kids directly from high school who don't have problems, who just want to go to college mm-hmm. and have the district pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some concern about that. But it also is, you know, there's also some concern about giving challenges to students. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, again, I think, you know, you might, in some of your models, look at the Beaverton program as one that's been particularly successful with offering that opportunity to students.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of other ones that's besides dual credit programs that have offered opportunities to students to accelerate their learning. So
Beaverton is pre-dropout stage.
Pre-dropout, yes.
Yeah.
Pre-dropout. Okay. They have, I think, about 90 students on the Rock Creek campus right now. Melody Cobb is the coordinator of that program.
Okay. All right, great. Colleagues, thank you, and thank you very much. All right, well, you'll just have to read about those great students in the newspaper, and if you have some more questions, I'm sure Ms. Tuttle is available to answer them by phone or in writing. Her card is in the folder. Yeah. Okay, so colleagues, what I'm going to do next is move to Senate Bill 300. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 300 and have some folks come up and testify. And I think Senator Gordley is out in the hallway. Ooh, we have quite a list. And I'd like Senator Gordley to lead us off, so we'll wait just a moment while Marjorie finds her. Hi, Senator Gordley, welcome. Did you have anyone you wanted to bring up with you when you testified?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries.
Okay.
And Mr. Chuck Bennett from COSA.
Great. Okay, if you'll identify yourself for the record and take it away. We've opened our public hearing.
Thank you very much. For the record, Abel Gordley representing...
I'm sorry. Senator Gordley, I do this all the time to my committee administrator.
Mm-hmm.
I always forget to have her do her part, which is to tell us about the bill. So if you don't mind...
I don't know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee...
Would you just nudge me every time I forget?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm sure your witnesses can explain this so much better. However, Senate Bill 300 comes to the committee. It creates the Expanded Options Program for students attending public schools in grades 11 and 12 who are 16 years or older. It allows these students to enroll in post-secondary courses for credit at eligible secondary institutions, And this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and Madam Chair, you do have a panel of people who have agreed to testify at the request of Senator Gordley, and you do have a number of other witnesses.
Great. Thank you very much. You know, Senator, we've been so involved in overviews and informational hearings, I forget about the important part that Marjorie plays in all of this. So now I would like to turn it back over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Education Committee. It's a pleasure to be before you this afternoon. For the record, I'm Avel Gordley, representing Senate District 23, which includes wonderful neighborhoods in Northeast and Southeast Portland. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for hearing this bill, Senate Bill 300, and I'll just say right up front that it also deserves a work session at the appropriate point. This bill comes out of a collaboration with my office and the Association of Oregon Industries, Associated Oregon Industries, that began in the 1999 session. The business community has noted the absence of a public policy and public education that directs when certain high school students are ready to take a course or courses at a community college or university that they should be able to attend, and that the class fees and course materials should be paid by that student's high school. The problem in Oregon is that while we have programs like this available in different places around the state, access and opportunity do not exist as a system approach, intentionally aligning high school to community college to university opportunities for all students who might choose this path no matter where they live in Oregon. What is needed is a public policy statement that places the student consumer of public education at the center and that makes it possible for students to move on when they are ready. This is about increasing academic and career opportunities for all public school students. This bill is about expanding options for students and removing barriers to moving from high school to colleges and universities. And again, the students' needs are placed at the center. I want to speak frankly, Madam Chair, and say that this bill is not about displacing so-called regular community college students with somebody's stereotype of an at-risk or dropout student. But this bill is about valuing and capturing human potential. This public policy discussion should not be tainted either with the politics of whether people like the political leanings of AOI, the organization most closely identified with sponsoring this legislative concept. AOI has proven to be a wonderful partner in this endeavor and others that concern the educational needs of Oregonians, including support for Head Start and other pre-kindergarten programs, support for Saturday school, and support for achieving excellence in education overall. Research tells us, and you will hear more about this from Mr. Matthews through his testimony and possibly from others, that this kind of approach and access works well for the students we are trying to reach who are at risk of dropping out or who have already dropped out. High schools as we know them do not work for all students or offer what all students need academically. We know that Oregon cannot afford dropouts for a host of reasons, and that what we should do, is put our energies into designing approaches that keep students and their talents and creativity in school. What we are trying to do here, again, is capture human potential and keep it viable and keep it working in Oregon. This bill will need some further work, and frankly, Madam Chair, I am depending on two people to help craft consensus amendments to make this bill work best for our students. I'm asking Mr. Harvey Matthews of AOI and Mr. Chuck Bennett of COSA to take the lead together in making this work. And I will tell you that after three sessions, 99, 01, 03, of strenuously working on the concepts currently in the bill, we ought to finally be able to move forward with the leadership of these two able gentlemen and anyone else who is committed to putting student needs first. In the past, we have had support from the Oregon University system. Community colleges last session moved from opposition to neutral and are now willing to work on the concept, aware of what may be financial challenges. We are pleased that the bill is being heard, and again, Madam Chair, the time has come for implementation of a policy in this area. And so I conclude by saying, let us get this done and in this session for Oregon's public school students. And I'd like to turn now to my good friend on the left and my good friend on the right. How about that seating order? And ask them to add to the record.
From the left.
From the left.
From the left. Yeah, I'm not sure that's the way this will sound. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. And I particularly want to thank Senator Gordley for her continued interest
and
persistent.
And you're going to state your name.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Chuck Bennett from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators.
Thank you. Now you can finish your thing.
I can be thankful again. for her persistence on this issue, we believe, and we have testified over the sessions outlined in opposition to this bill as it's written, but this bill runs to the individual needs of students, and that is the underlying issue here that has captured our attention and I think really captured our interest, along with talking with Senator Gordley about the various issues as she has seen them. We've had opportunities to meet with Mr. Matthews and others. I've attended innumerable meetings during the interim on the entire question of P16, P20, and the real change that's going on in Oregon education. You're going to hear from the Oregon Department of Education, and they're going to describe the kinds of issues that have developed around a seamless K-16, P-16, P-20, K-20. It depends on who you're talking to when you hear this, but let's just agree we're talking about a seamless system from either pre-kindergarten through a student's college experience. And I think as they describe it, you'll get a feeling for what the programs look like now, and I won't take you through them. But I would ask you, when you hear from the Department of Education, take a look at the glossary on page 8 in their handout entitled Accelerated College Credit Opportunities for Oregon High School Students, because it gives a whole new vocabulary to the issues that Senator Gordley has been talking about for the past several sessions. And you'll find out that this issue is really under discussion. But that doesn't mean that there don't continue to exist some real barriers that need to be addressed by legislation or state school board action or both. Before looking at the barriers and the action on them that could occur inside of a bill like Senate Bill 300, I'd like to at least mention sort of where COSA's interest in this, what is philosophically driving us. I think it'll sound similar to what the senator mentioned. Our threshold issue in this is that any action must be designed to create opportunities for children, and that's what it's about. It's not about administrators, teachers, classify. It's about those students and what's going on with those students' education. That has to be at the center of this discussion. And this opportunity has to include the clear aim of enriching the education, whether academic or professional technical, of those students. And it isn't just about whether or not the venue should change. Should they leave the high school campus to go to a college campus to have that experience? But it's will, whatever the program looks like, enrich their opportunity. As I said before, the problem with defining and addressing barriers is that the field is changing very rapidly. Let me just give you some examples off of tomorrow's state school board agenda to just let you know kind of what's happening out there. They're going to discuss high school requirements that will include alignment of high school graduation requirements and post-secondary entrance requirements. The entire area is essential as they talk about high school and college alignment. I mean, this is going on at the state board level. They'll be talking about the Oregon skill set, a career identification framework. And they'll be talking again about the pre-K-20 data integration system. And this is underway. That whether you pass this bill or not, whether you deal with this issue or not, this is happening. The question becomes, does the legislator want to get its oar in the water as the river passes by here? Despite the fact that this is moving along, though, there are a batch of issues that really do need to be addressed at some point. The state board can address it, the legislature, or both. But we hope you'll take a look at some of these issues as you examine whether or not you want to have Senate Bill 300 advance. It appears to be a good vehicle and a good opportunity to discuss them. Are there policy barriers that limit the ability of the education system, and I'm assuming a system like a K-16 or K-20, from fully using existing capacity, which becomes particularly important at times like these where finances limit addition of capacity. And it's just real simple. We don't have enough money in the K-12 system to meet all the needs of all the kids. The capacity exists out there in other places. Can we integrate and make sure that we fully utilize this really wonderful education system that runs from pre-kindergarten through graduate school and provide the best possible education for students in this state? And if we're not, why not? What's the problem? What are the barriers, and are the barriers valid? And are the students being served by continuing to have those barriers in place? Not special interests like mine or others, but are those students being served best? Do we need to eliminate barriers that preclude faculty sharing between high schools and colleges? Is the limitation imposed by licensure requirements an impediment? I think we have to ask the question as we take a look at losing AP or upper division courses in our high schools. Could we look around for adjunct faculty that could come in and offer those courses, or can we offer college courses at the high school level through accreditation at the college? So, I mean, this runs both ways. And in some cases, it's happening. I mean, this is, in fact, happening. Are there problems there, though, that would make this happen more broadly around the state? There's a clear need for policy guidance on online programs and probably a review of how these students are funded as part of the school funding formula. That's both, and that looks across the board. We've seen them down in Coquille had an issue develop, and a lawsuit has occurred about this. SIO has developed an online program, and we really continue to lack some sort of statutory construct around this, and we're sort of turning it over to the Department of Education and then apparently subsequently to the courts to make these decisions. And since we have you in town, it seems like a good opportunity to take a look at the issue. Who is going to control the money as we move into this seamless educational system? And this is probably kind of obvious and bingo on the whole issue, who controls the money. But we do need to ultimately take some time and talk about the money, and talk about the money in terms of the kids. And that's our group's interest. We feel like sometimes we get caught in it. We all get caught in it. Let's talk about the money. In this case, let's talk about the kids and see if we can find a way to provide this really exciting, seamless system and accomplish these goals for individual students. And any policy must make sure it doesn't interfere with existing programs, but also must take into account the barriers to a statewide system posed by our present localized community college system. We may need to take a look at that and take a look at the community college system, the integration with OUS. We definitely need to look at the situation where a high school student completes their community college course and finds out it doesn't transfer to their university of choice. And hopefully these are the kinds of issues that could be taken up in Senate Bill 300 and really assist this exciting process that's underway to continue. I hope this issue, as I said, can be explored further. It does warrant a full airing. It does warrant a full discussion, as the senator mentioned. Times are changing rapidly in education and in the structure of education. The question of educators and policymakers is whether they will assist this transition or ultimately try to impede it. And we're going to stand on the side of at least let's see what the problems look like and see if we can find some way to make the transition into this very interesting new education system work better and work to the benefit, again, of these individual children who are hitting the 12th grade without enough classes to make the whole thing interesting, who are waiting to get into professional vocational programs that have been dropped from their school district but are available at the community college, and all the other kinds of stories you'll hear about relative to this issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Mr. Matthews?
Hi, thank you. I'm Harvey Matthews from Associated Oregon Industries. We're the state's largest business association with over 23,000 members. And we're here today supporting Senator Gordley's bill because the number of students dropping out has a dramatic effect on Oregon's workforce. We want companies to relocate to Oregon, to your districts, to provide jobs, and if there isn't a substantial workforce that's well-trained, they just won't come. On a personal note, I've had the pleasure of being a public school teacher. I taught in the high school level, I taught honor students, and I taught at-risk students, and those are the students I think this bill would impact the most. They're the students that are ignored by the process. It's very difficult for teachers to teach to anything but the middle. And personally, I have names and faces of students in my history that I was not able to reach. And I think a bill like this, Senate Bill 300, would accomplish a very important task, that these students should not be allowed to go through our system and not be educated. As Senator Gordley mentioned, Associated Oregon Industries has been a partner with her on this bill since 1999. We've had some successes, some failures, and we're looking forward to this bill moving forward this session with your guidance, Madam Chair. Oregon's business community supports Senate Bill 300 because we recognize that there's an 18% dropout in our rate for high school students in our state. Almost one in five students do not finish their senior year, as going from freshman to their senior year. Senate Bill 300 represents one very good solution to that problem. We also recognize there are many other groups that are attempting other solutions, and we applaud that as well. We recognize that Oregon's student population is very diverse, and that oftentimes our pre-K through 12 system approaches them in a one-size-fits-all way. And we would like the approach by Senate Bill 300 that offers some alternatives that we think are useful to students. This allows 11th to 12th graders to get their college and high school credit concurrently, much like the presentation that we had before us. And this makes the most of students' time and energy, which also is very important to the business community. The business community also notices that seamless transitions in business keep people as consumers. We don't have that same seamless transition process in place for high school students going to college, and that's one of the reasons why we have a smaller percentage than the average in the United States of students completing college. And we also recognize that higher education is difficult for many students to access. As you all know, Oregon gets an F for affordability. And this, Senate Bill 300, gets students a leg up and off to a good start in higher education without incurring any debt. So for those reasons, in closing, we urge your support of Senate Bill 300. Mr. Bennett and I, under Senator Gord Lee's direction, will be working together, and we hope to work with you all individually as we come to a mutually supported conclusion. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a couple questions, and I sense that Senator Cruz has a few. Senator Gordley, do you know, I don't know if you were in the room when Ms. Huddle was testifying about Gateway to College, but she indicated that Beaverton School District already sends kids to the Rock Creek Community College campus to get college credits, and they have someone from the high school there on the campus to facilitate that. So obviously their school is already doing what you are looking at here. How many other districts are doing that? Do you have any idea?
You will hear facts and figures from the Department of Education.
Okay.
That will be more current than anything I can provide to you. I served on the Senate Interim Education Committee, and we requested an updating of Oregon's current expanded like options programs. And I know that detail and report was made available, and I'm going to defer to their knowledge. What we don't have in Oregon, while we do have individual programs scattered around the state, what we don't have is a systemic approach.
You did mention that in your previous remarks.
Exactly. And in the absence of public policy that says that an expanded options approach, if you will become a part of our overall seamless educational system, what we're left with is that fragmented approach where students may or may not have access and opportunity as it is currently defined in the bill.
And then let me ask this question, and then I'll turn it over to my committee. When my children went to school in Eugene, they went to Sheldon High School, and I don't think my daughter did not take advantage of it because she was taking college classes and graduated high school early, but my son did. He took classes that were offered at the high school, taught by the high school teacher, and they were college prep credits. And then when school got out and he graduated, we drove out to Lane Community College and we paid $15 to convert those high school credits into 6 college credits. And that was pretty good bargain, and it gave him 6 college credits he didn't already have. So let me ask you about that, because Mr. Matthews testified that students can get involved in this program and not have any debt, but it seems to me that the school district is losing some funds by participating in these kinds of programs. But if you do it through the college prep program, it's done at the high school, and then they go to the community college. So sort of alleviate some of the concerns I've been hearing about this program and why you wouldn't go with this approach.
I'm not sure why we wouldn't go with that approach. That's an approach, and I want to kind of go back at it because I want to make sure I understood it. You paid them to convert classes at the community college level,
mm-hmm.
thereby alleviating the school district of a debt that they would have had to pay for. Did I misunderstand?
No, the district didn't have a debt at all. He took the classes at Sheldon High School, and then when he graduated and got his graduation certificate, we went out to LCC and paid them, I think it was only $15. I mean, it was a very nominal amount, and we got a college transcript that these high school classes are now community college credits,
right.
6 credits, and then he
Then he signed up to go to the U of O, and he never went to LCC. But he started at the U of O with 6 credits in his pocket, which he ended up needing because his freshman year was not too good. He spent more time on the ski slope. But, you know, that's the issue, that he was able to take that opportunity, and it didn't cost anyone anything but us $15.
That's a great bargain and a great system, and the idea here, I think, would be to offer, make sure, to the extent possible, that's available statewide. Systemically, I'm not sure I apologize, I don't understand the question exactly. I think you're describing a situation that supports the idea that's being advanced here. I'm just surprised, I guess, that you had to pay the $15. That's the part that I thought, well, that seems like kind of cheap on somebody's part to require you to go pay the $15. But, you know, when you look at school districts and school district funding, right now we're spending, for different students, for different needs. A student wants to go to a charter school, 80% of their money goes to the charter school. A student goes into an alternative program, 80% of their funding goes into that. A student has special needs, 100% of the funding's being covered. I mean, there are different needs for different students, and this may well be, and I think that's what needs to be talked about here. Mm-hmm. Is there a different need here that is not being met under the existing allocation of resources? Our 12th graders who don't have a challenging academic program like I had when I was a 12th grader, I wasn't going to community college, I was just going to the little old Central Valley High School, and it seemed challenging enough to me. But there are, I didn't realize this. I've gotten clearly old enough, my daughter's gotten old enough, that I don't recall that you went to high school in your senior year and didn't have anything to do but turn out for a sports team and go to the prom and take a few electives. There's something that can be in some schools that can be dealt with, and a whole bunch of schools are dealing with it. And this is the kind of program. And I think the question again becomes, are there any barriers in the way? And I think that a big part of it is catching up with this very rapidly changing system. And I think that when the Department of Ed testifies, it's an eye-opener to hear what's going on and how fast this is changing, and whether or not it may be ahead of us on Senate Bill 300, and we need to take Senate Bill, you know, 300 plus to deal with the issues that are out there now. That's the reality of the situation.
Madam Chair, I would just add, perhaps, or hopefully for some clarification about intent, if you look at page 3 of the bill, starting on line 4, there's a description of a process that would involve the student's parent or guardian in assessing and determining an educational learning plan in cooperation with an advisory support team, the student's short-term, long-term goals, proposed activities, all of that taken into consideration in determining what course or courses and how they should be paid for, et cetera. And there's a process, in other words. And the student's participation in the program doesn't happen by happenstance. There's a notification process laid out in the bill where students and their parents would be made aware of the existence of the program and how it works. And again, it's a systemic approach.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Does that add to
your clarity? Yeah, that does. And that tells me that, you know, if the school district offers the college prep program, they would probably direct the student to do that. If they offer expanded options, they would do that as well. So,
and if I may say also, Madam Chair, and members, frankly, how the question is framed is so important, because if we set this up as something or describe it as something where the school district is going to lose something as opposed to saying, how is it that we can best serve or better serve the needs of our students when those needs appear? Then we come at it with a different kind of response. It's not about districts losing anything, but it's very much about meeting the needs that students have when they have them.
That's an important point. Thank you, Senator. Senator Cruz, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been thinking since I've been in this process of moving to a K-16 system, I guess, according to Mr. Bennett, I've been really short-sighted. I'd never heard of P-24 before. I thought you were talking about an airplane. But Umpqua Community College has an arrangement with Roseburg School District now, and I think it's relatively successful. I did have some concerns, and you talk about a seamless system, but at this point in history of the state of Oregon, the funding's still siloed. And I'm not sure that we necessarily move really quickly away from that sort of modality. If I look right at the here and now and the fact that in the governor's budget, community colleges took a disproportionate hit, and yet you're only allowing them to recover part of the cost of teaching the kid, it's an added burden. So I think we need to make sure that we aren't burdening one part of the system against another in this thing, because I don't see us moving away from siloed funding anytime soon. And the other thing, I look just at Douglas County, and Roseburg's got this relationship with Umpqua because they're right next door. Then you get into school districts that are an hour away from that sort of opportunity. I'm bringing this up now, Madam Chair, because these are the folks that are going to work on the issues, I'm assuming. I fully support the concept. I think this is great. And if this had been available even in Roseburg back when my daughter was going to high school, because she was, she had a 4 point and pretty much sleptwalked to getting a 4 point. And could have used an additional challenge, but it wasn't available at that point in time. So it's a great concept. I just want to make sure that the rural parts of the state where we have additional challenges are included in this concept as we move forward.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, absolutely. The principle of, I call it equity, must be an overarching principle in how we move forward. I believe that the question before us is what shall be the public policy of the state of Oregon with regard to expanding options for academic achievement of all Oregon high school students, mm-hmm. no matter where they live in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Senator Morissette?
Yes, thank you. I, too, have been dealing with this since 1999. And I guess my interest was piqued by the Marcola School District, who was concerned that they would lose... Okay. That the students remaining behind would lose access to advanced placement courses, which do exactly what Chairman Walker was talking about. A healthy high school can... a student can earn, a half year's credit in high school by taking the AP classes and passing the AP exam and get credit for it. One of the problems for some of the smaller districts is that they under this scenario, Marcola could lose a couple of critical pieces, and the students who remain behind would then be deprived of an advanced placement class. I mean, that's the flip side of what you're doing, and so our this is. So I agree, it's for the benefit of the student, but you have to look at both sides. Now, the other issue is there's a lot of talk at risk, and I'm not, you know, the students I think most likely to take advantage of this would be the higher achieving students who would tend to gravitate toward that. Now, if it was a matter of losing a... Okay, if a person is going to drop out and the ADMW that would go to the community college wouldn't be lost by the school because that person was leaving anyway. So that's... And so I guess I'm not... I too believe that that is a student priority bill. But I think we have to look at the areas where the students who were left behind would not have the volume to have some of the quality of classes that they would otherwise have. And that to me is something that needs to be worked on. Now let me ask another question.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, may I address your question? The bill, as it is currently drafted, leaves it up to a school district and its board to determine, define at-risk okay. student who is eligible.
Mm-hmm.
So that again, that's a local decision. I guess the other comment I would have on your comments is that not all high schools, as we currently know them, have AP programs. So again, this is about expanding access opportunity to AP-like programs where they do exist. And that may be a community college in some cases, in some communities around the state.
Thank you. May I follow up? Okay, there. I guess the question would also be, what about the schools who are on the brink of either consolidating or closing down, you know, shutting down? Forget the AP, forget the ADMW that would leave the district and deprive those students who remain of that quality. I agree. I'd like to see this bill move. I'd like to see it define some comprehensive policy that, as Mr. Bennett said, are developing in spite of ourselves. Right? You know, we don't want to necessarily sit and watch the world go by. We have an opportunity to participate and to provide equity throughout the state. Not all districts can have access to a community college for whatever reason. Now, I don't know how we make complete equity given the travel distance quality. You know, there are different internet access might be part of it, but so it's, I'm not opposed to the bill itself. I just want to raise some issues that have traditionally been issues, and looking at it from one point of view, you can argue it's the benefit of the students who remain behind that needs to be considered as well as those who leave.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I think that, frankly, we need to question an assumption that says that somehow there's going to be this mass exodus from school districts with students leaving and going to community colleges or to a university setting. It's up... according to the language, again, currently in the bill, it's up to a community college and it's up to a university to accept or not accept a student. So, again, I'm just suggesting that we need to question some of our assumptions about how many students would be participating And I also would question the notion of students being left behind.
Okay. There is a program that provides for exactly what you're talking about at the present time throughout the state. People can do that. In conjunction with their district and the community college, it can be done.
Senator Gourley, I think I read in the bill somewhere that the community college and the university can cap enrollment of these kinds of students.
Currently, Madam Chair, as the bill is constructed, that's correct.
Yeah, I thought I'd read that. All right, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have some other, we have quite a few people. Colleagues, I'm going to ask that we stay till 5:30 if you can. Greg, if you can't, it's okay. I didn't tell you that in advance.
Yeah, we start a 5:30 meeting in my health committee.
That's fine. You need to take a break to eat, so I'll stay here until 5:30. We've got about 12 people to testify, so is that... That's going to give you about 4 minutes each. And I want to take someone who is here from more than 100 miles away, and then we'll get back to the panel Senator Gordley had suggested. So I will take James Middleton and Julie Suhonik. And Julie's within the 100 miles, but you're with James, so why don't you just come up? And state your name for the record, please, and your affiliation.
My name is Julie Suhonik. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association. The Oregon Community College Association represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon, which serve over 330,000 Oregonians. We really want to just take a minute to thank you for this opportunity to testify, and also thank Senator Gordley for her continuing focus on students in education policy. As many of you know, community colleges do have a comprehensive mission. We do a lot of different things, including workforce training and lower division transfer. And we want to just keep the comprehensive mission in mind as we talk today about this one segment of the population that we do serve. Community colleges serve, in 0203, we served over 15,000 students that were 17 years of age or younger. Under these students, there are basically three types of high school students that we serve. Those seeking accelerated opportunities. These are students who are seeking to be more challenged than they are in their current high school environment. These opportunities are provided to students throughout the state. They are often in contracts with their local high schools. That can take on a variety of different forms. The community college faculty could provide the teach the course, or qualified high school teachers could do that. Also, there are different agreements about who pays tuition for those students taking those courses, and where those courses are taken. Are they taken on the community college campus or in the high school? We also provide opportunities for students who are not only 17 or 18 and younger, but at any age, who are taking adult basic education. This actually makes up about 20% of our FTE. And we serve students at all levels of education at this. What's important to know is that when we are teaching these types of courses, that they are rather expensive for community colleges to provide. They range between $3,500 to $5,000 per FTE. And there is no tuition reimbursement because of federal requirements for those classes. But we do serve those needs. They include your basic GED, English as a second language, adult high school, those types of things. In addition, in a subset population, we also serve students who come out of high school, who graduate, who go through the traditional means, but they're still not prepared for colleges. While I don't have a number here in Oregon about the number of students that fit into that category, we know nationally that about 50% of students graduating from high school are not prepared to go to do college-level work. So we're serving those students as well. And finally, we are really working closely with a lot of the high schools to continue efforts to move forward professional, technical, and vocational programs. Because the K-12 sector has been underfunded, many of them have had to cut those types of programs. But we're seeing a high demand. 32% of the fastest growing jobs require an associate's degree, which is a 2-year degree, and most of those are technical professional degrees. And we are working in connection with our high schools to extend our vocational and professional technical programs into the high schools. And three just quick examples of that. At Clackamas Community College, they extended their automotive technology course to 200 students and are beginning a welding course, which right now has 25 students with their local high school. At Rogue, they have partnered with Grants Pass High School and are working on food service as well as welding classes to, again, extend those programs to students that are interested in those. And finally, Mount Hood Community College is working with several of the high schools in that area up in eastern Multnomah County through the Center for Advanced Learning, which provides the opportunity for students to get professional technical degrees and early on. Basically, what we see is Senate Bill 300 provides a great opportunity for us to have this policy discussion. We think there's a lot of advantages to having students coming out of high school with a two-year degree. They move faster through the system. There's a lot less debt for the student. It's a very good, efficient way of using taxpayers' dollars. And we are very excited about this opportunity, and we welcome this discussion. And we hope that we can work with AOI and COSA, as well as Senator Gorley's office, to come to some consensus on this policy so that we could advance these opportunities for students. What I would like to do is introduce you to President James Middleton from Central Oregon Community College, who will just give you a perspective from the college viewpoint.
Thank you. I'm Jim Middleton, president of Central Oregon Community College, and I'd like to give you potentially an unexpected perspective on it. From Linda Huddle, you got a presentation that was sort of the poster child for this type of arrangement. In fact, Central Oregon is not a poster child for these kind of cooperative ventures at this point, but I'd like to bring the perspective of a new president in the job since July who is looking at building these type of cooperative ventures with our regional schools, and speak about how an initiative like Senate Bill 300 can feed that kind of initiative. Firstly, we see this as a really critical type of cooperation that benefits our communities and moves us toward the economic recovery that we need at a more rapid pace. Interestingly, it fits with some of my experience in previous life. A study completed close to two decades ago by Penn State University looked at how students, what was the factor that made students persist in the university, and they found very clearly that it was early exposure to test their interest and ability in a field. So a key aspect of this type of arrangement is allows students to test their ability in a collegiate class and to test their interest in specific major areas that can truly ignite or redirect them as needed. It really does give us a chance to tap a student's potential, to make their aspirations real, and to hopefully motivate our most highly talented students. It will get students to their goals more quickly. The few issues, though, that I'd like to raise for you as you would look at consideration in the discussion. Firstly, we must ensure that these type of cooperative ventures do result in truly collegiate courses, rather than transcripting experiences that may be better than the norm but not truly equivalent to what the college class is. Secondly, and I think this has been noted, we need to come up with solutions that do not pit the community colleges against the districts. We need to look at systems that benefit both and that we don't start into a struggle over that very thin dollar bill in the process that loses the student interest in the process. There is a challenge, particularly in a time of diminished resources, that though we hope that this is not a displacement, as the community colleges have had to reduce the number of courses taught across the state, that a flow of students from this program may possibly displace some adult students. One of our challenges in the community college system is that though we would hope that new students and enrollment expansion produce additional income, it actually does not. The only way under our current funding formula that you get additional resources is if you grow faster than everyone else grows. So one aspect of it, every community college in the state grew at a 10% rate, no one would get a dime more. So we must look at how it relates to those aspects so that we have a system that encourages expansion of the courses tied to the funding that is a motivator as far as that's concerned. And lastly, one other perspective that I think was well spoken to in Linda Huddle's presentation is we also need to make sure that as we have students coming forward that the community colleges are not taking on an added role of student services that are really high school level student services. Particularly as we look at the at-risk students, they will bring with them a number of additional special needs that need to be addressed. We do not want to leave them underserved in the community college setting if we do not also produce the student service support necessary for them.
Thank you, Mr. Middleton. And Ms. Suhanek, you raised some very good questions and very good points about the struggle over that thin dollar bill. I appreciate your comments about that, and I was not aware that your funding did not increase unless you grew at a faster rate, so that was also a very good point. All right.
Thank you
very much. I'll just tell you who I'm going to go with next so you can know when you're coming up next. I'd like to take Salam Noor from the Department of Education, David McDonald, and Karen Sprague from OUS if you want to come up. And then after that, I'll be hearing from Rob Kramer. And then after that, Deborah Andrews and Joseph Lee. And then we'll tell you the rest of the people as we move along. So that'll just give you an idea of when you're coming up. And you get about 3 to 4 minutes apiece. Wish I could give you more time, but we didn't expect we'd have this many people to turn out today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Salam Noor, Assistant Superintendent in the Oregon Department of Education, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you here today relative to accelerated learning options and opportunities that are currently available in our high schools for high school students. A handout should be coming your way. The handout that I'm going to address is titled Accelerated College Credit Opportunities for Oregon High School Students. And I hope that this handout at this point provides you some context for all the wonderful information that you received about the variety of programs that are available for students in our high schools.
Mr. Noor, I have one question right off the bat. It says draft, draft, draft all over the bottom of it. Can you explain why this is a draft?
Correct. Madam Chair, it's draft because we're in the process of editing the document, improving the language in the document, and updating the data. This is based on last year's data.
Okay.
So I appreciate you pointing that out. It is a draft document, and we will continue to improve it, and I'll make sure that you get copies of the most recent edition, which hopefully we will have in about 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay, so, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Mainly, what I, in the interest of time, I really just wanted to provide you some information that informs your thinking and your decision-making relative to this bill as you go through the process of review and analysis. But I also want to take an opportunity to also thank Senator Gordley for her continued commitment and concerns about all students and ensuring that our education system continues to serve every single student in the system and try and accommodate them to meet their individual needs and circumstances. The programs listed in the document have been described briefly. The Advanced Placement Program, which we have in many high schools throughout the state. The International Baccalaureate Program is fairly recent to the state. We only have 13 high schools participating. But the dual credit, if you would turn the page, if I may direct your attention to page 4, the dual credit and the tech prep program they may sound familiar to you, Senator Walker. Those are the programs that have been in our state for a long time. What I would like to suggest also is that these programs are based on national protocols. For example, the Tech Prep program is part of the national, it's a nationally funded program through the Carl Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act. It allows students to participate in 2 years of high school in high school for 2 years in a program that leads to technical preparation, advancing to a community college. Engineering courses, technical courses, electronics courses fit very nicely into this framework. The dual credit and the tech prep are often referred to as 2+2 college high, college credit now. So there are local flavors, if you will, that come into play in terms of what colleges call them and how they offer these opportunities for their students. What's critical here is that these programs allow a high school student to take college credit while they're in high school, to take courses that satisfy both their high school credit, their high school graduation requirements, and also to apply those towards a college credit. I also would like to stress that these programs, they're unique in many respects because they are locally developed. They are arrangements that are reached by an individual high school or an entire district and their local area community college or university. And these arrangements typically address issues concerning requirements for curriculum and course approval to ensure that the course content is rigorous, that the course content is challenging and collegiate level, if you will. They also address requirements relative to instructional qualifications and preparation to teach that course to ensure that the instructor, if it's a high school instructor, has the skills and the credentials that a community college would accept as that credit transfers to the community college. They also address if the courses, the technical courses specifically, are part of a state-approved program that's approved either at the secondary level or community college level. They address student admission to the program, the standards and requirements a high school or a district would establish to that program to provide access. They address the number of college credits based on course completion and proficiencies, and they also address the transcripting of that credit in terms of how many college credits would be transcripted for that course. And those are things that are locally determined, if you will. There are in the states, however, some new models that are emerging that are true innovations because they are unique and they vary from place to place, but they have taken the concept and they started to craft relationships, and they're collaborative models truly collaborative between high schools and community colleges and universities. In some cases, it's a high school and a number of community colleges that are participating in that program. The PACE program in your document that's available at SIO involves students going from SIO High School to Chemeketa Community College and Len Benton Community College, and currently they're exploring some possibilities with Oregon State University. So they are truly providing a seamless system and a seamless educational continuum for students to take advantage of. And students complete their high school credits while also taking college credits. The arrangement that they have reached with the community college is to actually pay for tuition, pay for books, provide transportation, and also facilitate some counseling between the community college counselor and the high school students. And this is also an opportunity to train high school teachers on how to counsel students and inform them about transitioning to college and the opportunities that they have available to them. This document also highlights a number of other programs. The CAL, the Center for Advanced Learning Programs, that was just mentioned, is really a partnership between four school districts and a community college, Mount Hood Community College, that provides similar opportunities for students. High schools, districts coming together, agreeing on how to share their resources, how to collaborate on the courses that they want to offer their students, and how to arrange that with a local area community college. I don't want to take too much time, but I also want to share with you that the State Board of Education is very much connected to these programs, is very interested in them, and is trying to address them at a policy level. P16 is something that you heard about briefly today, and that really establishes a continuum of education that allows a student to achieve his or her full potential while in high school. And if that involves transitioning to a community college or a university while in high school, then that's something that the high school should be able to arrange with those institutions. But I just wanted to stress that the board is very much interested in these programs and trying to address them in a policy context that continues to promote these types of innovations but doesn't really restrict or establish limiting boundaries, if you will, that end up, unfortunately, limiting or minimizing the opportunities that are available for students. I also want to echo what's been mentioned already relative to the policy context. I think the Department of Education would welcome having a policy conversation relative to Senate Bill 300, because I think it does facilitate that opportunity to have that policy discussion and also to address some of the questions and the concerns that we have and a number of other partners may have about that relative to the one-size-fits-all concept. Typically one model may not work everywhere because of the local needs and circumstances and issues concerned. The impact on the program, Senator Morissette addressed that very thoughtfully in terms of the impact on existing programs at the high school level or the community college level, if you will, by trying to accommodate a number of students to have an unintended consequence that affects the program that may be available to all students. The funding arrangements that need to be considered, these currently are addressed at the local level. We don't really dictate how they use the ADM. Some colleges are able to access 85% of the ADM. Some colleges access 95%. These are local arrangements that are done without our intervention, and the system actually allows for it currently. And also the capacity issue to accommodate students at the community college or university level in particular. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be happy to take any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you. Well, I think we'll hear from the other two folks, and then we'll probably have some questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dave McDonald, Director of Enrollment Student Services in the Chancellor's Office and the Director of the Oregon Gear Up Project. I have 4 points, and I will endeavor to keep it under 4 minutes. The first is accelerated learning is certainly on the agenda of the Excellence in Delivery Productivity Work Group, which is one of the OUS board work groups chaired by President Gretchen Schutte of Chemeketa College, or Community College. We are looking at this as an activity in concert with K-12 and community colleges, again, looking at what's best for the students. The second point is that we share the concerns of all the previous speakers regarding the funding. We need to make sure that as this type of activity is rolled forward, that there's an equity issue, that we don't leave students behind and don't have unintended consequences to other schools and such. That said, we are very supportive of this conversation. The handouts that I have for you, there are two handouts that we're providing you. They are paperclipped together. The first one is on one of the many statewide efforts that we are engaged in. A number of the efforts are based on campuses, and Dr. Sprague, whom I'll introduce in a moment, will talk specifically about one activity at the University of Oregon. But Advanced Placement is a national program. We are committed, working with the Department of Education, with Oregon High Schools, to increase the number of students who have opportunities to take Advanced Placement and other rigorous courses. The Gear Up program, which I manage, is a federally supported program that works with our schools that have highest degrees of poverty, typically the schools that have the least opportunity for students to take more rigorous courses. The charts I provide you show that through some very intensive and intentional activities we've done with the schools, we have greatly increased the capacity of those schools to offer AP courses to all their students, increased the number of students who have taken the AP courses, and most importantly, increased the percentage and number of students who have done well in those courses. It's not simply good enough to offer more courses. We need to make sure that the students do well by virtue of those courses. The back of the handout gives some information on Gear Up as well as where our Gear Up programs are located. The last point is that as we look at this PK-16, PK-20 continuum, please be aware that there is a dual enrollment part that deals with community colleges to the Oregon University some campuses, and I've provided you some information on that because I think it's healthy to look at this as a total continuum that benefits the students. And in fact, the SIO example that Dr. Noor mentioned, those students may indeed be doing SIO Lynn Denton Community College through that arrangement and Lynn Denton OSU dual enrollment, so that we can really put these programs together to help fit and design a program that best serves what the student needs. With that, I'd like to introduce my colleague from the University of Oregon. Dr. Karen Sprague is a professor of biology, and she also has the other hat of vice provost of undergraduate studies.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate your listening to us this afternoon. As Dave said, my name is Karen Sprague, for the record. The University of Oregon, I would say, is very enthusiastic about the goal of this bill. We very much like the encouragement that it conveys to students for taking on academic challenge. And we also very much like the emphasis on broad access that this bill conveys. With respect to that same goal, the University of Oregon has tried to put its dreams into action through something that we call the DuckLinks program. DuckLinks, ducklings, I apologize for the pun. This is a program that's been in effect since, I think, 1999, which allows students in local high schools who've exhausted the academic possibilities for them there to enroll in one or two classes at the university. It started out quite small with just a partnership with the most immediate school district, the 4J school district, but it's been enlarged over the years to include all 8 of the districts that are in or around Eugene. I think there are something like 40 students on average at the university each term, taking all sorts of courses. There are no limits, really, on what courses they can enroll in, but one of the things that's very important for making this program work is good advising to assess the students' interests, capacity, maturity, and suggest appropriate courses. And I've actually met a few of these students informally because I've served as a sort of informal science advisor. But I noticed that Senator Gordley was emphasizing the sort of systemic nature of her bill, and that resonated with us because that's a very important part of making something like this work. List the courses you need, good advising to connect students with the appropriate ones. As I say, from our perspective, this works very nicely. We, as far as we can tell, the students are happy with the courses they take, and the high schools are happy having those students with us. I think there was originally an enrollment cap on it, but there is no longer. And some 600 students, I think, have gone through it since it began.
Dr. Sprague, I have a question for you. Does the school district reimburse you for the students that come take classes at the U of O?
The way it works is that the university pays the tuition, which is on the order of $100 a credit right now. The student or the school district pays the fees. So that's another $150 or so dollars per credit.
Okay.
And I don't know to what extent school districts actually pay those fees. The fees are paid to us, but I don't know.
We only have three school districts in the Lane County area. Well, you could go down to Cresswell and Cottage Grove, in the immediate city you'd have Bethel, 4J, and Springfield, and then Junction City. So do you do something with all of those?
Yes, we do. We do. Okay. We here's my list of school districts that are participating.
Well, that's okay, because we probably need to move on, but the answer is you don't know whether the student is paying that extra fee or whether the district is, and the university is eating the cost of the class.
That's right. Okay. Of the instruction.
Are the students who come take classes, do you admit them as regular students, or how do you handle them at the university?
They are considered part-time students.
Okay.
Yes. And there are, in certain cases, there are students who are admitted as full-time students who are still in high school, but that's rare.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right. I think there was a question I had, and I can't remember what it was, but if I think of it, I will send it to you in writing. I think it was with you, Mr. Knorr, because it looks like there's a lot of schools doing a myriad of programs that sound similar to what we're talking about here in Senate Bill 300. So I'll raise those with you later, because we've got about a half an hour to hear everyone else. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Kramer, I'll hear from you next, and then after you is Deborah Andrews and Joseph Lee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify on behalf of this bill. My name is Rob Kramer, and I am president of the Oregon Education Coalition, which has its offices in Portland, Oregon. I think this is an idea whose time has come, and I admire Senator Gordley for her persistence in moving this concept forward now for the fourth straight session, and I'm delighted by the coalition of supporters that she has put together this session. We know big ideas in this body tend to be very complex and take several tries to get through, but I think that the time is ripe for this particular big idea. Because I think the Expanded Options Program is good for Oregon students. We need to do something to make the last 2 years of a student's high school experience more relevant, because too many students tend to sleepwalk through those last 2 years. It's very easy for a student to meet all of the academic credit requirements by senior year, take a couple of elective senior year, get early release, and basically do very little in his or her senior year. I have a 10th grade daughter, and I kind of see that future for her in the next couple of years as well. And I think that's a tremendous waste, not only of public resources, but also of the opportunity for all students to maximize what they can get out of their K-12 educational experience. And we all know we need to reduce the dropout rate. A new study came out just this week from the Manhattan Institute, which I'll pass out, that compares Oregon's dropout rate to other states. We come in 30th. And we've struggled with this for a long time. We all know we need to do better. I think this is one element of how we can do better. We also know that there will be people who will object or oppose this particular bill because they'll perceive it to have some cost to the system that can't be recouped. I think that's short-sighted, however. We've heard many people talk about the myriad of programs that are basically doing this in one way or another all over the state. The question is, are we going to allow this for every student? That's the question. And there are places that are doing real innovative things along these lines. The SIO School District has the PACE program, in which 25 students from SIO and some neighboring school districts are accessing both Chemeketa and Lynn Benton Community College and taking higher level courses there. And so it's happening. The train is running down the track. And the real question is, does the legislature want to be a part of designing how this will be available to all students? Because there is nothing under current state law right now to prevent a school district like SIO or any other school district in the state to start a charter school made up of nothing but 11th and 12th grade students, in which the district simply contracts with the nearby community college and runs this as a charter school and steps in the middle of the income stream. That could happen under current state law right now, and we could essentially have this program for all students operated by one school district, which in its would, you know, have the prospects of essentially enriching itself by designing this program. So I think that it is an arena that the legislature needs to be involved in, kind of designing how this will be offered for every single student. And I am delighted that that I can be in any way a part of helping move this along. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Any questions from the committee? All right. Thank you. And you must be Ms. Andrews.
Yes, I am.
Would you identify yourself and your affiliation, please?
My name is Deb Andrews. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm the parent of a doctoral student that started college at 13. He almost dropped out in the fourth grade, which left me with a passion for education. I have a handout that's coming your way that details my story on the last page. I applaud Senator Gordley and this committee for bringing forward SB 300, the early options bill to expand options for students attending Oregon public schools. The effect of this bill will result in a focus on individual learning, encourage and allow students to reach higher than is traditional in our schools, facilitate students accomplishing much more than many dreamed possible, highlight the need for education to be considered a seamless K-16 endeavor. However, I urge you to amend this bill as follows to promote student learning and progress, eliminate unnecessary record keeping, and discourage sabotage. Eliminate the credit hour caps and age restrictions. Early entry to college courses should be based on instructional need, period. Student learning is not naturally restricted by age. Schools have designed that system of organization, but it has nothing to do with learning. You could instead restrict entry by weight, but why? Allow all children to learn new information when they are ready. Do not allow individual school districts to define at risk. That has potential for real harm. The emphasis should be on making sure all students get this information, not just a select few. Early options should be offered based on instructional need, period. Extra effort should be made to include those Oregon students in schools that have traditionally not provided effective instruction and challenging curriculum, the students in the much publicized gap. School boards should not be given responsibility to affect individual student progress. According to the National School Boards Association Executive Director Ann Bryant, and I quote, "School board members are instructed to not think of themselves as a representative for their constituency. I am aware of a young man who was extremely bright. The school never provided him an appropriately challenging curriculum. He never caused any problems, however. He just began staring out the window more as time went on. The school was unaware how abusive his home life was. He would never have been considered at risk from any perspective except the one behind that family door. This young man was presented no options in school. He gradually became schizophrenic, was institutionalized, and committed suicide. Make no mistake, this bill addresses real learning of new information and may change how we think of providing services to students. To focus on learning is a welcome, novel idea. I would like to share with you what a parent shared with me last week. Her child had been identified as eligible for a specialized program for highly gifted children. During the parent informational meeting organized by the school district, the parents were told it was preferable for their child to instead attend the neighborhood school, even though the child would not have the curriculum or instruction that would have been provided in the special program. The parents were advised their child could be with neighborhood kids, be little teachers, and teach the slow kids. I don't think educators in China or India are making those recommendations to parents of children who process information rapidly. That, senators, is a waste of my money, let alone wasted human potential. I urge you to pass this bill with no age restrictions, credit hour cap, artificial risk limitations, or school board interference. Send the message loud and clear: educational services provided to children in Oregon will be guided by learning new information when the child is ready. On the third page above my op-ed piece is a note I received from a teacher friend. She was sitting at another in-service training that had nothing to do with instruction. During that time, she passed around my editorial to her friends, fellow teachers, and she says, "You hit the nail on the head. My op-ed piece is about curriculum and instruction being left behind. I think this bill will assist in that regard." Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Andrews, and thank you for providing your op-ed piece. I had actually read this and put it in my collection of materials related to education that I read in various newspapers.
Thank you
for your testimony.
Appreciate it.
And thank you, Mr. Kramer. Is Joseph Lee still here? Oh, he's a student? Okay. And then, Joseph, after you testify, I'm going to have Lori Wimmer Whalen, Tricia Smith, and Connie Green come up as a panel, and then we will back clean up with Robert Castagna and Andrea Meyer. So there you go. Thank you, Mr. Lee. State your name and who you're with.
My name is Joseph Lay, and I'm a student from Lincoln High School in Portland, Oregon. I'm currently a junior. I'm speaking on behalf of Superintendent Castillo's Youth Advisory Team.
Oh.
For those of you who are not familiar with the team, we are comprised of approximately 25 members from across Oregon. All are at least the age of 16. And we advise the superintendent not to approve this bill as it stands now. We have two main reasons for this.
Okay.
The first is we are concerned about to whom the opportunities under this program, like who the opportunity is extended to. We feel that the language in the bill tends to direct the expanded options program towards the at-risk students, which is not something that is necessarily a good thing, considering that we are talking about college courses and college credit. And particularly Section 17.3 deals with if there's an overflow of students in a certain school district who wish to benefit from this program, priority will go to the at-risk students. And we do not like the wording in this because we think that there should be more of a balance between helping the at-risk students up and also allowing the more outstanding students to excel. Section 6 deals with college or high school dropouts and extending the opportunity for them to take advantage of this program. And we were also uncertain about this. The general consensus from the advisory team was that we would like to see this stricken because we do not feel that high school dropouts should be allowed to take advantage of it simply because they have not shown sufficient motivation in order to succeed at the college level if they couldn't succeed at the high school level. Our second main point was that there should be a more narrow field of courses that students are allowed to take if they do take advantage of the expanded options program. We would like to see the courses narrowed down to core classes such as English, mathematics, social studies, and possibly the sciences. Because as it stands now, the bill has rather loose wording regarding what courses can be taken. For instance, there is a basket weaving example that was offered earlier. A student, if they were interested in basket weaving under the bill, could actually take such a class at a community college and have the district pay for it, which we do not see something that is necessarily beneficial to the system. And so we wanted to see the system, we would like to see the bill more narrow in terms of its language. I would like to give a personal touch on this, if I may. My school, Lincoln, has a number of IB courses, which are International Baccalaureate, offered at it. And so, for me, I'm taking a complete course of these IB classes, so there is no need for me to benefit from something such as the Extended Options Program. However, I can certainly see where the program would be useful. For instance, in the same district, Portland Public Schools, Jefferson is taking advantage of something very similar to this. It's working in conjunction with Portland Community College, and the principal at Jefferson is a friend of our family, Larry Dashiell, and he said that the work he's doing with PPC or PCC is actually the only thing that is keeping Jefferson afloat. I believe their enrollment's down by some 300 students right now.
Thank you, Mr. Lay. I really appreciate your testimony. It was very thoughtful. You went through the bill and explained to us the concerns you have. My question to you is your advisory group, if these things that you pointed out that raise issues with you, if those things were corrected, would you then support the bill?
Yes, we would. We wholeheartedly support the idea of extending options to students.
Okay, great. Do you have any questions?
I think you'd be a good addition.
My colleague here is work group crazy right now, so he said you'd be a good addition to the work group, and I agree. If one is appointed, we'll give you a call. Thank you, Mr. Lay. I really, really appreciate you coming down today.
Thank you.
Okay, do you have to leave? Okay, Senator Starr needs to leave. Our committee normally ends at 5, and I didn't give them advance notice, and so I appreciate you staying at this late. I will stay here, and Senator Cruz will stay here until he needs to leave.
Yes.
So Lori Wimmer-Whalen, Tricia Smith, and Connie Green, could you come up, please?
Good evening. Madam Chair and committee member, for the record, my name is Lori Wimmer-Whalen, and I represent 43,000 community college and K-12 members of the Oregon Education Association.
That's a lot of members.
That's right. And I'm also the mother of a student at Lincoln High School who's a sophomore, so that was pretty exciting to see Mr. Lay come up.
It was.
Yes. I'm handing out to you my written testimony as well as a little chart that I've put together for you. I'm kind of a type A person, and I like to pay attention to detail, so I thought that if I'd made that as easy as possible for others to follow my logic, you might be appreciative of that. I can also go faster that way. I think that my testimony is really about unintended consequences and not intended consequences. We unfortunately are standing in opposition to the bill, at least as it's written, because, and as we have for the past three sessions as well, and I might point out that last session we had an agreement with the Associated Oregon Industries and others who sponsored a bill on professional technical education that we supported as an alternative to this, and it was our understanding that that was where we were going to be going, and so we were a little dismayed that that agreement didn't apparently hold. We did testify in favor of that bill, and it passed.
That bill passed?
Yes, it did.
And was signed by the governor?
Yes, it was sponsored by the Speaker of the House.
And can you give me the bill number on that, please?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't, Madam Chair, but I will be happy to supply it for you.
That's fine, because I don't recall it. Even though I was here last session, I don't happen to recall that bill. Thank you.
You're welcome. We support the development of programs that are tailored to meet the educational needs of students. We know that buildings that are called schools are not walls that are constructed to hold up roofs. They're there to educate kids. So the allusions that you may have heard earlier in the evening to the contrary, we'd like to make that point for the record. Our members are there to serve the needs of students, and our remarks should be seen in that context, please. We believe that whether through accelerated learning, dual enrollment, advanced placement courses, the international baccalaureate programs, and other arrangements that you've heard more than 33,000 students across the state already participate in, where there is the geographic proximity to an institution, access to internet-type studies, resources, and so on, those programs are already being done, and we feel that those offer inventive strategies to prepare students for a life rich in possibilities, both in terms of career and advanced education. Having said that, however, we believe that with this bill, there is a devil in the detail, and that's why I provided you that chart. Those are the devils that we see. I would also point out that in 1999, when this bill got a huge work group and a lot of hours were spent, we participated in that work group and prepared a whole set of amendments that we would have been prepared to support the bill had they been adopted, and not a single one was. We also worked then with the Associated Oregon industry lobbyists, who came to us with another proposal that they advanced that we could support, and we got as far as actually drafting it in the LC, and then they withdrew support of their own amendments, and the bill then died as a result. So it is not that we have been obstructionists with respect to coming up with crafting policies that have, that do provide legitimate options, and as you can see, those options have flourished out there, absent the need for the legislature to weigh in. But I'd like to remind everyone here, though perhaps you don't need a reminder, that we have been through a pretty grueling 4 years, since 2001 especially. K through 12 has taken $800 million in cuts, and that's not about the institution again. That is about the students and the losses that they've suffered as a result of those impacts. We stand ready to lose another $400 million perhaps in this coming two-year budget period. Gone are many of the services, staffing, courses, activities, and enrichment programs that ironically not only give breadth to the school program for all learners, but particularly retain students who might otherwise become dropouts. When those enrichment programs go away, our dropout rate increases. And so at this very time when we are suffering most economically, putting an unfunded mandate on the schools that would take even more money out of the system of serving all students in the regular school program as well, similar to what Senator Morissette said, seems to me counterintuitive. This is not the time to be doing that. 4 years ago when the bill came forward, there was a fiscal impact statement done of the school districts. I'm not talking about the Department of Ed piece of that. I know they've got a $300,000 fiscal impact on this bill for this time. But for the districts themselves, and again, these are four-year-old numbers, so it's probably higher now. The impact was stated to be $5.2 million to school districts. Now, yes, families who don't have to pay tuition and whose students get two free school years of college, in effect, whether they are wealthy or at risk or however their economics work, that is nice. That's a nice luxury in some cases. But the other side of that coin is that when money leaves the district and they have fewer dollars to work with to serve all students, there are other students who won't have the same programs and courses and services in the school building that they would otherwise have with a richer pot. So that's just one set of issues. One of the other things that I'd like to point out to you is that there are some logistical and accountability related issues that concern us as well. One of the things that'll happen, we believe, is when you mandate something, it then, of course, is a required program. And as we've seen with special education and other mandates, when you mandate something, it becomes where the resources flow. If we have 33,000 students doing other things similar to the expanded options program now, those dollars will switch out of, especially in a resource poor environment, switch out of those voluntary programs and over to this expanded option program, because most school districts simply will not have the means to do both. And so the unintended consequence I alluded to earlier would be that you will take away successful programs from students who are enjoying them and using them now in order to redirect the funds to this new mandate. Other things is there is no performance standards. You don't have to have completed your sim. You don't have to have a particular class standing or grade point average. There's even a structural problem in the wording of the bill. On page one, it says that it's for all students who are enrolled. And then on an inside page, it says that dropout students who have already dropped out, which by my definition means they're no longer enrolled, would be eligible for the program. So there are all kinds of technical problems that we see.
Ms. Whalen, did you detail these in your testimony,
yes.
Your written testimony?
I'm just giving you the high points so that I don't have to read it all to you.
And I understand that, but it's 525. And
I can end here.
You've left me with a lot, and Senator Gordley is in the front row listening as well. And I appreciate this. I'm as technical as you are, and so this is very helpful, and I'll take a look at that. But
thank you, Madam.
I'd like to move on to Ms. Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA represents 20,000 educators in K-12 schools and in community colleges. And as Ms. Wimmer-Whalen has told you, this is a bill that's been here for many sessions now, and we've been involved in it in each of those sessions. You have heard many reasons why there are concerns with this bill as it's written, and I'm not going to take your time to reiterate those. We agree with the position of OEA and the points they make in their handout to you. And so rather than repeating them, we will tell you to read that. That's what we think as well. Our biggest concerns are that in this world where we are cutting basic education programs in K-12 that students desperately need in order to succeed in K-12, it's not the time to require K-12 schools to outsource their students to other institutions along with the funding that goes with them. I personally have two students who are at separate ends of the spectrum in schools, and one of those students is a sophomore this year at high school here in Salem. He will have completed, he is a learning disabled TAG student. I didn't know until I had him that there were such things, but there are. And he's one of them. He's been taking AP classes since middle school, everyone that he can get his hands on. He will have completed his high school diploma requirements. I think he has 7 more credits before he can complete his high school requirements. And he is looking forward to the options that his high school will provide to him in his junior and senior year to take classes through them in college. Those classes and those opportunities already exist for him, and he will be ready for them. My other son, though, was a classic example of the child left behind in this scenario. He desperately needs the classes that high schools offer to high school students and the extracurricular activities that keep kids like Patrick interested in high school. And those are the classes that our high schools are losing every year. They're losing them. And with them, they lose a significant number of kids. When you cut the music program is why the child is in school, then the child leaves the school. If you cut the music program to provide a college opportunity to another child, I'm not sure that that's the mission of our K-12 system. We need to, if we lived in a perfect world like the Walgreens commercial says, then this would be a fabulous program because we'd have plenty of money for all of the other things that we need in our high schools. Right now, we have less than we've ever had, at least in my lifetime, in our high schools, and we need to be focusing on providing math in high school rather than college opportunities for high school students who've already completed their math. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Ms. Green?
Madam Chair and members of the committee that are not here, I will make this very short. I am with Community College and Workforce Development, and I will be seeing, I'm Connie Green, and I will be seeing some of you again tomorrow morning as we do our Ways and Means presentation. Mm-hmm. In that presentation today, we touched on acceleration options and what do community colleges do. And you've heard about it. You've seen the brochure. You know the things that we're doing. And Community Colleges and Workforce Development is very supportive of working with this committee and with Senator Gordley to find a way to make these kinds of options work. The things we have on the table that we're already doing, the last thing we want is for a bill to stop those things. The other thing you don't want to do is to create a funding crisis that's already existing for K-12 and community colleges. You heard today about the Ways and Means, about how many less sections we had, how many less students we've served because of less resources. We know we need to create options and hope. We know we have students at all levels, and we want to work with Senator Gordley if he put together a work group to be part of that, because we believe together we need to find ways for students to accelerate when possible and to be able to keep moving as when they're ready to move and not have any of the system stop them. But in these constraining financial times, we need to find a way to do that that makes sense.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Green. Thank all of you. I appreciate your time. And we'll hear finally from Robert Castagna and Andrea Meyer. If you have written testimony, you can submit that, and if it's written, just hit the high points, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference is the public policy office representing the Catholic bishops of Oregon. In service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Catholics, and in service of the common good to the people of the state of Oregon. Madam Chair, we're here today, and Senator Cruz, to testify asking for an amendment to this bill so that it might apply to all students who are resident in the state of Oregon, regardless of whether or not they are enrolled in a public school. We believe this is an equity issue. As we've heard in previous testimony, the focus of this bill is to address the needs of students and to provide opportunities for students. And we believe that that opportunity should apply to all students. As students who are not now currently enrolled in public schools can participate in athletic programs, we believe that this type program, which is intended to enhance the academic opportunities, should also be extended to all students who are resident in the state of Oregon. May I give you an example? St. Mary's Academy is in downtown Portland. They have a student body population of about 565 students. About half the population of the student body is Catholic, the remaining non-Catholic. 20% of the students are minority students. 30% of the students are on financial aid. In the last three academic years, including this year, about 12 students took a total of 13 courses at an institution of higher education. I'm presuming it's Portland State University, since it's right across the street from St. Mary's Academy. We think that those students benefiting on an individual basis should be eligible for this type program. And if the legislature intends to move forward with this initiative, which we think is a great initiative, we would like to see the state prize all the resident students of the state and make all students eligible for this program.
Thank you, Mr. Castagna. Do you have a question? Okay. Ms. Meyer?
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. I'm here just to raise a concern that we have about the language and urge that if this committee does go forward, that it should amend the bill to make it clear that it does not, the definition of post-secondary institutions does not include religious institutions.
Good panel.
I thought we make nice bookends, don't we?
Yes, we do.
These are accredited institutions, I might add.
Absolutely, but as if to the degree that Senate Bill 300 would require expenditures of K-12 taxpayer money for tuition, textbooks, transportation and fees, and other costs associated with attending a post-secondary school, it runs afoul of Article 1, Section 5 of the Oregon Constitution, which states in part, quote, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury for the benefit of any religious or theological institution. In 1961, the Oregon Supreme Court in Dickman versus School District No. 62 addressed an almost identical issue here and held that furnishing textbooks with K-12 taxpayer money to students enrolled in parochial schools violated the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 5. In that case, the court explicitly rejected the argument made by the proponents of that proposal that the benefit was given to the student, not the school. The court rejected that. The court stated, quote, in the instant case, the evidence establishes that the defendant's school district here, the public school district, expended approximately $4,000 over a three-year period for textbooks used in the St. John's School. This constitutes a substantial benefit. The benefit of such character of such a character as to bring it within the prescription of Article 1, Section 5. I should note that the court actually noted it didn't matter that the textbooks were actually loaned to the school rather than given outright. In Dickman, it's important, I just think, worthy to note quickly the portions of the court decision that said, a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States holding that certain legislation is not a violation of the federal constitution is not an adjudication of the constitutionality of the legislation under a state constitution. In such a case, it is not only within the power of the state courts, it is their duty to decide whether the state constitution has been violated. Our views on this policy or interpretation of a particular constitutional provision do not always coincide with those of the Supreme Court of the United States. And in fact, in that case, the Oregon Supreme Court held contrary to a U.S. Supreme Court decision of a very similar type of situation. So we urge this committee, if it proceeds forward, to make it clear in the statute so that there's no confusion as to the limitations to comply with Article 1, Section 5. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Senator Cruz.
So what you're saying is, for example, Willamette University across the street, with it, which is a Methodist college, should not be eligible for this.
Senator Walker, Senator Cruz, no, and we've actually sued about 20 years ago on the issue with higher education. And while I don't have the words in front of me, it's a school that requires students to comply with a particular religious tenets and mission. So it's not simply that a school has as its core mission originally the imprimatur of a religion, but that as part of someone attending, they must attend religious courses, sometimes church, and other requirements in a sectarian.
Well, followed, Madam Chair, I don't know what the curriculum at Willamette is now, but when I went to Willamette, you were required to take religion classes.
Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, we've looked at Willamette. I don't recall that there's any problem with it right now. Taking a religion course that is course that covers religion in and of itself is not a problem. If it is a course that you're required to take that only covers a particular religion taught from that perspective.
Right, this could lead to a longer discussion than we have time. My health policy committee is meeting.
Senator Cruz, I would encourage you and Ms. Meyer to get together and chat at length.
Senator Cruz, I'm happy to talk with you and provide you where we have distinguished the difference, but it is there is a line.
All right.
And there's differences in opinion.
And thank you both for attending.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I appreciate it. And I would like to thank my staff and for Senator Cruz for hanging in there with me past time. And I know that Senator Gordley appreciates all the thoughtful comments that were had today. And this committee will, we will adjourn the public hearing, and this committee will adjourn. Thank you.